Chapter 22. Washington closed down after a dazzling clear day. The crisp fall weather sharpened the air as the setting sun glazed the white granite of the government buildings into a gold-like porcelain. The sky was sprinkled with cotton ball clouds that looked solid enough for the Gulf Stream 4 jetliner to land on. The plane could carry up to 19 passengers, but Pitt, Giordino, and Lily had the main cabin all to themselves. Giordino had promptly fallen asleep before the plane's wheels lifted from the U.S. Air Force base at Thule and hadn't opened an eye since. Lily had dozed on and off or read Marlis Milheiser's The Threshold. Pitt stayed awake, lost in his thoughts, occasionally making entries in a small notebook. He turned and stared out the small window at the homeward-bound traffic slowly beating its way from the core of the Capitol. His thoughts wandered back to the frozen crew of the Serapis, its skipper, Rufinus, and his daughter, Hypatia. Pitt was sorry his eyes had failed to find the girl in the darkness of the cargo hold, even though the video camera had recorded her quite clearly, arms circled around a small, long-haired dog. Gronquist almost cried when he described her. Pitt wondered if she would end up as a frozen display in a museum, viewed in hushed astonishment by endless lines of the curious. Gazing down at the Washington Mall as the Gulf Stream circled for its approach, Pitt put off his thoughts of the Serapis and focused on the search for the Alexandria Library treasures. He knew exactly how he was going about it. The part of his plan that didn't thrill him was putting all his eggs in one basket. He had to bank his entire search on a few lines crudely scratched in wax by the freezing hand of a dying man. Murphy's Law, whatever can go wrong will go wrong, was already erecting the barricades against him. The lines in the map might not fit a known geographical location for any number of reasons. Distortion in the wax from rapid temperature changes during the initial freeze on the Serapis and later thaw on board the Polar Explorer. Or perhaps Rufinus erred in the scale and misplaced the curves and angles of the shoreline and river. Or the worst and most probable scenario, great changes in the landscape due to soil buildup or erosion, earthquakes or extreme changes in climate during the past 1,600 years. No river in the world had maintained an unvarying course over 1,000 years. Pitt smelled the intoxicating scent of challenge. To restless men it is a real scent that wafts somewhere between a sexually aroused woman and newly cut grass after a rain. It tempts and addicts until the challenger is oblivious to any thought of failure or danger. The excitement of the chase meant as much to Pitt as actual success. And yet, when he did achieve the near impossible, there was always the inevitable letdown afterward. His first obstacle was lack of time to conduct a search. The second was the Soviet sub. He and Giordino were the front-running candidates to oversee the underwater salvage operation. Pitt's reverie was interrupted by the pilot's voice over the speakers to fasten seatbelts. He watched the plane's tiny shadow enlarge against the leafless trees below. The brown grass flashed past and turned to concrete. The pilot taxied off the main runway at Andrews Air Force Base and braked to a stop beside a Ford Taurus station wagon. Pitt helped Lily step from the plane. Then he and Giordino unloaded the luggage and stacked it in the rear of the Taurus. The driver, a young athletic prep school type, stood back as if afraid to interfere with the two hardcore types who handled the heavy suitcases and duffel bags as lightly as pillows. "What's the plan?" Pitt asked the driver.
"Dinner with Admiral Sandecker at his club."
"Admiral who?" asked Lily.
"Sandecker," answered Giordino. "Our boss at Numa. We must have done something right. It's a rare treat when he pops for a meal."
"Not to mention an invitation to the John Paul Jones Club," added Pitt.
"Exclusive?"
Giordino nodded.
"A depository for rusty old naval officers with bilge water in their bladders." It was dark when the driver finally turned into a quiet residential street in Georgetown. 5 blocks later, he eased the car onto a gravel drive and stopped beneath the portico of a red-brick Victorian mansion. In the entrance hall, a short gamecock of a man strode across the carpet dressed in a tailored silk suit with a vest. He moved in rapid, energetic steps like a cat sneaking through a door crack. His features were sharp and always reminded Pitt of a griffin. The deep red hair on his head connected to a meticulously trimmed Van Dyke beard. His eyes seemed filled with spit and vinegar. Admiral James Sandecker was not the kind to creep into a room. He took it by storm. "Good to see you boys back," he snapped in a tone more official than friendly. "I hear your ancient ship discovery may change the history books. The news media is giving it big play."
"We had a few lucky breaks," said Pitt. "May I present Dr. Lily Sharp, Lily, Admiral James Sandecker?"
Sandecker beamed like a lighthouse when he was in the presence of an attractive woman, and he went luminous for Lily.
"Doctor, you have to be the loveliest lady ever to grace these walls."
"I'm happy to see your club shows no discrimination toward females."
"Not because the membership is open-minded," said Giordino slyly. "Most women would rather get a tetanus shot than come here and hear old derelicts rehash the wars."
Sandecker shot Giordino a withering stare. Lily looked at the two men, puzzled. She thought perhaps she was caught in the middle of a long-standing feud.
Pitt forced back a laugh but couldn't suppress a smile. He'd witnessed the give-and-take for 10 years. Everyone close to them knew Giordino and Sandecker were the warmest of friends. Lily decided to make a tactical retreat.
"If one of you gentlemen will point out the ladies' room, I'll freshen up."
Sandecker gestured up a hallway. "First door on the right. Please take your time." As soon as she had left, the Admiral motioned Pitt and Giordino into a small sitting room and closed the door. "I have to leave for a meeting with the Secretary of the Navy in an hour. This will be our only chance to talk in private, so I'll have to make it quick before Dr. Sharp returns. Let me begin by saying you did a damned fine job finding the Soviet sub and then clamping a lid on it. The President was most pleased when he received the news and asked me to thank you."
"When do we start?" asked Giordino.
"Start what?"
"A covert underwater salvage operation on the sub."
"Our intelligence people insist it be put on hold. Their scheme is to feed Soviet agents misleading information. Make it appear any further search is a waste of taxpayers' money, and we've written it off as a lost cause."
"For how long?" Pitt asked.
"Maybe a year, whatever time it takes for the mission project people to draw up plans and construct the equipment for the project."
Pitt stared at the Admiral suspiciously.
"I get the feeling we won't be included."
"Dead on," Sandecker said flatly. "As they say at the police precinct, you're off the case."
"Can I ask why?"
"I have a more important job for you two characters."
"What could be more important than stealing the secrets of the Soviet Navy's deadliest submarine?" Pitt asked guardedly.
"A skiing holiday," Sandecker replied. "Nothing like the invigorating air and the powder snow of the Rockies. You're booked on a commercial flight to Denver tomorrow morning at 10:45. Dr. Sharp will accompany you."
Pitt looked at Giordino, who merely shrugged. He turned back to Sandecker.
"Is this a reward or exile?"
"Call it a working vacation. Senator Pitt will explain the details."
"My dad?"
"He's expecting you later this evening at his home."
Sandecker pulled a large gold pocket watch from his vest pocket and read the ivory face.
"We must not keep a pretty lady waiting."
Sandecker started for the door while Pitt and Giordino stood dumbly rooted to the room's faded carpet.
"Don't hold back, Admiral." Pitt's voice was sharp. "Unless you play it straight, there's no way in hell I'll be on that plane tomorrow."
"Accept my regrets, too," Giordino said. "I feel an attack of Borneo jungle fungus coming on."
Sandecker paused in mid-stride, turned, lifted an eyebrow, and stared directly at Pitt.
"You don't fool me for a minute, mister. You don't give a damn about the Soviet sub. You want to find the relics of the Alexandria Library so bad you'd give up sex."
Pitt said with forbearance, "Your insight is flawless, as usual. So is your underground grapevine. I intended to turn over the transcription of the Serapis's log to you on our return to Washington. Apparently someone beat me to it.
Commander Knight. He radioed Dr. Redfern's translation in code to the Navy Department, who turned it over to the National Security Council and the President. I read a copy before you left Greenland. You opened Pandora's box and didn't know it. If the cache exists and can be found, it will cause a political upheaval. But I'm not about to go into it. That job was given to your father for reasons he's better qualified to explain."
"How does Lily fit in the picture?"
"She's part of your cover. A backup in the event there's a leak or the KGB suspects their sub was actually found. Martin Brogan wants to make it clear you're working on a legitimate archaeological project. That's why I'm meeting you at the club and your father will brief you at home. Your movements must look routine should you be tailed."
"Sounds like an overkill to me."
"The bureaucracy works in mysterious ways," said Giordino resignedly. "I wonder if I can get tickets to a Denver Bronco game."
"I'm glad we see eye to eye," Sandecker said with some satisfaction. "Now let's find our table. I'm starved." They dropped Lily off at the Jefferson Hotel. She gave them both a hug and entered the lobby, followed by a porter with her bags. Pitt and Giardino directed the driver to the 10-story solar glass building that was the headquarters for the National Underwater and Marine Agency. Giardino went directly to his office on the fourth floor, while Pitt remained on the elevator and rode up to the communication and information network on the top level. He left an attaché case with the receptionist and removed an envelope, slipping it in his coat pocket. He wandered around the seemingly endless rows of electronic equipment and computer hardware until he found a man sitting cross-legged on the tiled floor contemplating a miniature tape recorder dissected from a large kangaroo doll. "Does it sing Waltzing Matilda off-key?" Pitt asked. "How'd you know?" "A lucky guess." Hiram Yeager looked up and grinned. He had a droll face with straight blonde hair tied in a ponytail. His beard, curled in long ringlets, looked as if he had borrowed it from a costume rental. He peered through a pair of granny spectacles and was dressed like a down-and-out rodeo performer in old Levi's and boots a bag lady would throw away. Sandecker had pirated Yeager away from a computer design company in California's Silicon Valley and had given him free rein to create NUMA's data complex from scratch. It was a perfect marriage between human genius and central processing unit. Yeager supervised a vast library of information containing every known report and book written about the world's oceans. Yeager studied the doll's recording and speaker unit with a critical eye. "I could have designed a better system than this with kitchen utensils." "Can you fix it?" "Probably not." Pitt shook his head and gestured around the computer complex. "You set up all this, but can't repair a simple cassette player?" "My heart isn't in it." Yeager rose, walked into an office, and stood the stuffed kangaroo on one corner of his desk. "Maybe someday, when I'm inspired, I'll modify it into a talking lamp." Pitt followed him and closed the door. "Feel in the mood for a more exotic project?"
"Along what lines?"
"Research."
"Lay it on me."
Pitt removed the envelope from his pocket and gave it to Yeager. NUMA's computer wizard slouched in a chair, opened the envelope flap, and withdrew the contents. He rapidly scanned the typed transcript, then read it through again more slowly. After a long silence, he peered over his spectacles at Pitt.
"This from that old ship you found?"
"You know of it?"
"Have to be blind and deaf not to. The story has been all over the newspapers and TV."
Pitt nodded at the papers in Yeager's hand. A translation from Latin of the ship's log.
"What do you want from me?"
"Take a look at the page with the map." Yeager held it up and studied the unlabeled lines.
"You want me to make a match with a known geographical location?"
"If you can," Pitt acknowledged.
"Not a hell of a lot to go on. What is it?"
"An ocean shoreline and a river."
"When was it drawn?"
"AD 391. Yeager gave Pitt a bemused look.
"You might as well ask me to name the streets of Atlantis."
"Program your electronic playmates for a projection of the ship's course after the fleet left Cartagena. You might also try working backwards from the shipwreck site in Greenland. I've included the position."
"You realize this river may not exist anymore?"
"The thought entered my mind."
"I'll need authorization from the Admiral."
"You'll get it first thing in the morning."
"All right," Yeager said glumly. "I'll give it my best shot. What's my deadline?"
"Just stay with it until you have something," Pitt replied. "I've got to go out of town for a while. I'll check in with you the day after tomorrow to see how you're doing."
"Can I ask a question?"
"Sure."
"Is this really important?"
"Yes," Pitt said slowly. "I think it is. Maybe more important than you and I can ever imagine."